I like to keep lots of secrets, but I like to share them everywhere.
Oh dear.
Typically, I've been keeping my secrets in Keybase, which does a number of different things, but one of the facilities it has is a private key store that it will synchronize between your devices that are running Keybase. And mostly I've used this when I've been on open source teams and we want to democratize administration responsibilities for servers and things, and you want to share keys amongst the core team so that if one of you is on holiday or in hospital or whatever it might be, there are other people that can access the keys and all of the security credentials in order to take care of, you know, housekeeping and what have you.
So this is the very, very first time I've heard of a legitimate use of Keybase other than signing up for the website, putting all the relevant codes on various other websites to prove who you are, and then friending other people. As soon as Keybase added some crypto nonsense, I was like, nope, noped out. And I basically removed it from everything, and I haven't touched it since. I probably still have an account. I don't know.
Yes, I understand your concerns. That file synchronization feature and the secrets folders thing has worked really well. But Keybase, as a bit of software you install on your computer, is a bit finickety. It's a bit memory hungry. And it was getting in the way of me doing stuff. And I went looking for another way to have the secrets that I need that I don't use very often. So this is not a I've changed my password manager story. I'll get into what these secrets are. But I wanted to put my secret somewhere that I could synchronize, but they were synchronized in an encrypted form. And I found a marvelous piece of software. And there are others that are similar, but I have settled on a bit of software called GoCryptFS. And it's an encrypted overlay file system written in Go, hence the name. But if you're on macOS, it is in beta on macOS, so you can run it on macOS. And if you're on Windows, there's a C++ implementation called CPP CryptFS.
That's weird. Like a cross-platform language like Go, and there's like completely different implementations elsewhere. That's strange.
Yeah. Anyway, it's the same implementation on Mac. It's from the same project on Mac. It's just not it's a Linux native thing. It uses Fuse to do the mounting of your encrypted secrets. And the reason I liked it is I looked at a bunch of the different tooling, and GoCryptFS came out on top for me because it was fast to do the encrypting, decrypting, and adding things to your key store, and it was extremely easy to use. And I can actually articulate how easy to use it is. You type at the command line, but you don't have to use the command line. We'll get to that later. At the command line, you type gocryptfs-init and a directory name, and that creates a folder, which is now somewhere you can place secrets. And then you mount that using gocryptfs. You say gocryptfs, path to where the secret is, that the secrets that you've just initialized are, and a directory you want them mounted in an unencrypted form. So I have syncthings/secrets, which is my encrypted store, and I mount those under /vault in my home directory. And in /vault, I can just toss anything in there, pictures, text files, anything I like, and it automatically gets encrypted into the secret path. What I actually have in my secrets is a backup of my GPG keys, a backup of my SSH keys, a backup of, believe it or not, my Mumble certificate that I generated donkeys years ago, stuff like that. But what I also have in there, and why I wanted to use this, is when I deploy my workstations and my servers, I have already pre-generated the SSH host keys that I want to be on those servers. So I keep the host keys for all of my machines in my secrets, so that when I do a deployment, I unlock my secrets, and my deployment tool then seeds the deployment target with those secrets in order to, you know, do stuff.
So this isn't your SSH key that you're using to log in. This is the key that the server uses to identify itself.
Correct.
Right. Why do you pre-generate those?
So that when I redeploy a system, I know that it's the system that I deployed because it's using keys that I've already generated and verified.
Right. So you'll never, if you ever log in via SSH and you get the thing saying, oh, the host's identity has changed, you know that something's gone wrong there.
Exactly so.
This is a sideways way of Martin telling you he screws his machine up a lot and has to keep redeploying it all the time.
It's the Nix way.
No, it's what it actually is that when I deploy my NixOS machines, I also use a system called SopsNix, which manages the secrets in that deployed machine. And I need some master keys that handle the decryption of the secrets that are in the deployment, and that I have to deploy out of band. That can't be in the Nix configuration. That has to be somewhere else. So that's where I keep those master keys to handle the deployment as well.
And you were talking about sharing keys for administering open source projects. Is this suitable for that use case as well?
It is. So I briefly mentioned earlier that the path I have my secrets in is /syncthing/secrets. So should one day I need to use this mechanism to share to other members of a project, you can put the encrypted password store in a SyncThing folder, share that device ID with members of your project, and it will synchronize over SyncThing the encrypted secrets, and then you can share with your trusted inner circle the decryption key for those secrets, or the encryption passphrase for those secrets, and then they can unlock the secrets and access them. Now, I mentioned command line stuff, and the command line stuff is super simple. When you're done, you can just do fuser mount minus u path to where you've mounted it, and it unmounts and you're all done. But there are wonderful graphical user interfaces for GoCryptFS, and there are plenty of them. But there are two that I think stand out head and shoulders above the rest. And my first pick there is an application called Vaults. That's a GTK4 application for Linux. It's beautiful, super simple, hides all of the complexity of the software and just works. If you're on Linux, and probably you are if you're listening to this podcast, I recommend that one. But if you're using one of the other platforms, or you're using many platforms and you want the same user interface everywhere, there's a tool called SiriKali, and that's implemented in Qt, and that runs on Linux, Windows, and macOS, and that also works beautifully. So you can do the unlocking and mounting of your encrypted file store and accessing that encrypted folder just fine using both those tools. And this is just so elegant. I love it.
So the fact that you're using SyncThing under the covers to do the synchronization means you're in control of who can see that via the shared device IDs, and you can see when that's synchronized. When you mount it, I'm always a bit worried about two machines making a change to a file that's in SyncThing at the same time. So if you and another person are both using these shared secrets, I imagine you have to have some kind of control over who's writing to them. I guess mostly you're reading from them because you want to use the keys and so on to unlock something. It's not that you're constantly updating it, so that's less of a worry, I guess.
Yeah, these are not frequently changing files, so you shouldn't run into conflicts. But if you did want to sort of protect against that, me as the project owner, I could share that sync thing as a read-only.
Oh, that's a good point.
Sync, so that the downstream's consumers get a read-only copy, so right, they just get what I'm sending.
And you could still mount the read-only vault.
Yeah, because it's only read-only in the context of sync thing, not in the context of, you know, what you've got on your disk.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Anyway, it's very nice. There are other tools like this, but I've found this by far the easiest to use. And GoCryptFS does have performance in its back pocket. So if you're looking for a way to encrypt, I don't know, things like documents for, you know, your home insurance, you know, lots of large files, it can actually consume and handle large data volumes just fine. So this could be a way to do the same thing, but with like your critical household documents synced to any cloud storage anywhere. So in the case of, you know, disaster, there is an encrypted copy of your most critical information that you can then access in order to deal with whatever disaster you've encountered. I know that's a bit, you know, macabre, but, you know, there are other ways you could use this.
A few episodes ago, Martin spoke about something which nerd sniped me a bit.
You're welcome.
You spoke about funny fonts with extra bits in, and one of the reasons for having the extra bits was a tool called Powerline.
Yes.
So I went looking at this to see what it was all about then, and came across Powerline Shell, which is a Python script for making your shell prompt extra fancy. I think Powerline was originally for Vim, but there's various versions of it for various things, including for your terminal shell.
Yep.
And I installed this and had a play and thought, oh, this is nice. Lots of, you know, things about what Git repository you're in and what directory you're in and whether the last command had an error code or not. And then I got thinking, if I was to write an extra little widget for this, what would I do it for? And I have a problem at work sometimes whereby I will check out the code for a client's Moodle site, or rather I'll open up a previous checkout of the code for a client's Moodle site, and I'll assume it's running the latest version of Moodle, or at least the latest version of Moodle they're on in production. But I might have checked this out a very long time ago, and I'll start merrily doing some work, and then I'll commit it, and I'll go to push it up, and I'll be pushing it to the wrong place against the wrong version.
Wow. I thought I was the only imbecile who did that.
Nope, we're all imbeciles here.
Brilliant.
So I thought, well, what if my power line could tell me which version of Moodle is in my current directory? So I merrily set about coding this up in Python and got it working. And the way it works might not be the most elegant way, but it works. You can go and have a look at the link in the show notes if you want to see. And I then looked at how I might submit this as a module to the project, and I realized it wasn't really being maintained anymore.
Oh dear.
I didn't really want to be maintaining a fork. So I asked Martin, because I thought, well, if Martin's been using this, he probably hasn't been using a version that's not being maintained.
He has not.
So what's Martin using? And Martin told me,
Powerline Go.
Right. Powerline Go, which is the same idea, but instead of being written in Python, it's written in Go.
Just to be clear, the one that you installed that was written in Python, did you go and get that from somewhere else, or did you get it from the archive?
No, I got it from the GitHub page, I think.
Ah, okay. I don't know which one I'm running. I apt installed Powerline.
I think that might be the Bash implementation.
What? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, might be.
Yes. So mine was called Powerline Shell.
Right.
But it's written in Python. So I had a look at the code for that, and I worked out where all the modules are for each of the little widgets, and I converted my code to Go.
Well done. How did you find that?
With the help of our mate Chatty Jeeps, it was quite easy. I sort of got it to suggest something that might be correct and then had a fiddle around with it. I've written Go before, I should say. This wasn't me just like launching into Go. I wrote my Raspberry Pi powered doorbell in Go a while ago.
Ah, right.
So I got that working, and then I pushed that up to a GitHub fork and went to make a pull request. And then I thought, okay, so what are my instructions for testing this? And I looked at trying to tell someone how to install Powerline Go from my fork. But I hit a bit of a problem, because if you've forked something on GitHub and then you try to install it with Go install, the repository on GitHub doesn't match the Go module in the code. And so it gets upset, because mine is called marksjohnson/powerlinego
right
on GitHub, but the module is called theoriginalauthor/powerlinego, and it doesn't right. like that. And so I thought, how am I going to solve this then? And I went poking around a bit, and then I realized Powerline Go supports plugins.
Ah.
So I didn't need a merge request at all. I could just build a completely separate thing. And it's actually really flexible the way it works, because all it does is if you try and load a module into your prompt that doesn't exist, it goes looking for an executable called Powerline Go, that module name. And if it can execute that and it spits out a valid bit of JSON, it'll just use that in place of whatever the Go function would have returned.
So you just put your compiled binary in the right place, called the right name, and so long as it spits out some JSON, which is whatever, the Moodle version number or something,
yeah,
you're done.
Exactly. So you tell it what it should say and what colours it should be, essentially. And it doesn't even have to be written in Go. It can just be anything executable. But because I'd already converted my code to Go, I thought that's also very handy for distributing it, because compared to distributing Python stuff and making it installable, distributing Go stuff and making it installable is much easier. So then I thought, well, what's the easiest way I can tell someone to get this piece of code that will make it executable and in their path? So I thought, I'll build a snap.
Uh-oh.
Actually, no, not uh-oh at all. It worked really well. In fact, it was easier than last time I tried building a snap. Following the documentation, I found it was all up to date and easy to follow, and it worked. So I managed to... the trouble I had was I run Docker on my work machine where I was building this, and you can't build a snap on a machine where you're running Docker without some jiggery-pokery.
Oh, this is LexD and Docker having a punch up in the garden.
Yes, you need there's network shenanigans going on. So I thought, well, what if I just circumvent that by getting GitHub Actions to build it for me?
So I think we should just explain for the uninitiated what LexD and Docker having a punch up in a garden actually means.
No, I don't think so. No, that's fine.
Try it and find out for yourself.
You could also do Snapcraft remote build, and then it just sends the code up to Launchpad, builds it there, and then pulls down the snap.
I didn't know that.
And then you don't have to use LexD locally at all.
Okay. I'll remember that for the future. So I got it building on GitHub as I got it just building a static Go binary, and then I got it building with Snapcraft as well to build a snap and test it out. I then wrote another GitHub workflow to do some testing. I didn't actually do any unit testing in Go for this. All I did was I had it grab the binary and check out the Moodle code base in my GitHub action and then run it and see if it did what it should do.
It's good enough, isn't it?
Yeah, and it works. Then I looked at what the upstream Powerline Go project does, because they have builds in various architectures as releases on GitHub, and they use a tool called Go Releaser. So this is another YAML file to stick in your project and another GitHub action workflow. But what that will do is build it for ARM x86 and AMD 64, and it can create a GitHub release with all of those, and it can also build your Snapcraft file and publish it to the Snap Store for you.
Yes.
So I now have all of that happening. I can push a release with, I think I've made it so that if I tag a release with a version number, it will do all of this building and testing. And then if that all passes, it'll build it for everything, make a GitHub release with the static binaries, and build the snap packages and push them to the Snap Store.
Isn't CI awesome?
It is.
I didn't realize Go Releaser had support for building snaps. I built snaps, I mentioned this a while back, of Sift and Gripe for work, and I'm just consuming the upstream binaries. But when I mentioned this to the team, they were like, oh, we use Go Releaser, so we could just, you know, if we bring this in-house, we could just spit them out with Go Releaser. So I might go and look at the way you've done it and might do a pull request against our internal stuff so that we could try out building and publishing the snaps straight from GitHub.
I'd be interested to hear about that.
I'll be interested to discover it as well. So thanks, Mark. I received an email.
It happens sometimes.
I have stories from the trenches about email.
Yes. All right. You've tricked me into it. I'll tell you some more. So actually, we all received the same email. If you send feedback to us using the contact form, or you send it to show@linuxmatters.sh, it comes to all of us, including Joe. And an email from a listener, Graham the Dev. Hello, Graham. They wrote in recently to offer the sale of a dual-up monitor. And knowing that Martin had a couple and Mark had one, I jumped at this and said, I would please like to rip your arm off as I take that monitor out of your hands. And me and Joe had a punch-up in the garden, and he also wanted it. But I prevailed.
I've just got this visual image of you and Joe in the beer garden of the hotel at the old camp having a brawl over a monitor.
No, none of this happened. So the reason I was interested in this is my current work setup is a MacBook Pro and two 1080p screens. And I wanted something a little bit higher resolution. And so I thought, well, the dual up is too higher than 1080p screens, basically. So I thought, yeah, I would quite like that. I contacted Graham and he pointed out that he lives near where Og Camp is happening. And would we be there? And I said, yes, let's do it. So once we got to Manchester, we then exchanged brown envelopes via PayPal and a gigantic cardboard box with a monitor in it. And at this point, I had to figure out how to get it home from Manchester. Now, bear in mind, I caught the train from Basingstoke with Martin all the way up to Manchester, and I was catching the train back on the Monday. And so Graham kindly dropped the monitor off on the Friday, and it was a bargain. Thank you, Graham, again. And I left it in the hotel room, making sure the carpet didn't fly away because it's quite big and heavy. And then I had to figure out how to get it home. So I did get it home. We lugged it to the train station and I stuck it in the luggage area on the train. And it was fine.
It turns out getting to the train station like half an hour before your train is due to leave secures you safe passage with large luggage on the train.
It certainly does. Sidebar, I've put in a complaint to cross-country trains, not because of a luggage-related issue, but because my seat was sold twice, once to me and once to somebody else. And the guard on the train told me I should complain to the organisation. I've heard nothing yet. Anyway, more on that later if I hear anything.
The guard on my train also told us all to complain to cross-country because it was so crowded.
Ah, I wonder if it was his last day and he just didn't care. It's just telling everyone, yeah, you should complain, you should complain, you should complain. Anyway, I got the monitor back to Basingstoke, where my office is, and took it in. And then a couple of days after Old Camp, I got it out of the box and set it all up. And I did not put it on my desk and replace the two 1080p screens. I actually put it behind me on an empty desk and plugged my ThinkPad Z13 into it. And that's where it stayed. And so I haven't actually replaced my work setup at all. I've augmented my work setup with another monitor behind me connected to a completely different computer. And I was quite pleased that I just plugged the USB-C cable in and it's the only cable attached to the laptop because the power from the monitor goes down the USB cable and powers the laptop. And the display signal goes the other way up the cable to the monitor and drives the full whatever resolution it is, 2x2 and a bit or whatever it is, K. And I've just got it configured as one giant square monitor with GNOME Shell. And it works perfectly. I love it.
Out of interest, have you tried plugging the MacBook into it?
Not yet. There's no real reason I haven't tried. It's just my work setup is on the other desk and I would rather like leave all my work setup where it is. I might try it out tomorrow or before we next record and tell you if it works, if I end up doing anything interesting with it. But I'm really pleased with it. It's really nice. I've actually got the brightness dialed all the way down to the bottom because it's a really bright display.
Yeah.
They are, yes.
And actually the desk is got some space. I've noticed that I can swing it round to one side and I could probably fit another one of those dual up displays on that on that desk. But yeah, it's good enough. There's some rather interesting things that I could do with it. Now I've got a very high resolution display attached to that Linux workstation. And I'm finding actually really pleasing looking at web pages with the full
portrait. Yes.
Yeah. I do a search and then end up on Stack Exchange, which is taking up like, you know, a quarter of the width of the screen. And I have to zoom it in to, and it's just lovely. I love it.
So as I grow older and my eyesight gets worse, I love the fact that I can punch up the zoom in on the browser to like 150, 175% on lots of websites and get rid of the white space left and right of the column that it displays and make these perfectly readable high resolution websites. It's kind of delicious.
Yes. And there's some other good things I'm doing with it, which I'll probably talk about in the next episode. But I just wanted to say thank you to Graham for offering the mates rates deal on the LG Jewel Up. And it's in excellent condition. And I'm very pleased I got it.
Wonderful. And there it is. To be a proper presenter here, you need a Steam Deck and an LG Jewel Up. So we're all qualified now.
Actually, I tweeted out today that I'm thinking of selling my Steam Deck. So
you can't do that. No, you can't do that.
Qualify myself.
It's the end of Linux Matters.